The Katra Podcast, Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are, well, we're tackling maybe the greatest villain in Western history, the ultimate embodiment of evil.
It's a big topic.
A huge topic. But here's the thing. We're not debating theology today. Not at all.
No, this is different.
We are doing a deep dive into the cultural biography of this figure. We're tracing the history, the evolution, and really the construction of the devil himself using Darren Oldridge's fantastic book, The Devil, a very short introduction.
And it is an incredible subject. What's so fascinating and what Oldridge makes really clear is that he isn't debating whether a supernatural entity exists.
Right. That's not the point.
His whole mission is to trace the, 2,000-year history of the idea of ultimate evil.
And how it changed.
Exactly. So the core thesis we're diving into is pretty simple, but it's also, I think, really profound. The devil is not some fixed static figure. He's a powerful and very malleable human construction.
That's what makes this so relevant for you listening right now. The devil, as a concept, basically acts as a cultural mirror.
A mirror, that's a perfect way to put it.
By tracing the biography of this one idea, you get this amazing shortcut to understanding Western moral history. Every time the devil changed his costume or his methods, it tells us exactly what that society feared most.
What they valued, who they needed to exclude.
It's the ultimate story of how we define ourselves by what we oppose.
To understand our history, you really have to understand the monsters we've created.
So before we get into the history itself, let's talk about the historian who's guiding us, who is Darren Oldridge.
Okay, so he's a professor of early modern history at the University of Worcester. And his specialty is just, I mean, it's perfect for this.
What is it exactly?
He focuses on the religious and supernatural beliefs of the 16th and 17th centuries.
Ah, so the Reformation, apocalyptic thinking.
And crucially, the great European witch hunts. He's right in the thick of it, academically speaking.
That background is so key. It gives him this very distinctive, non-theological perspective.
Totally. He approaches the subject as a meticulous cultural historian. He's not arguing for or against belief. He's analyzing the devil's origins and development using, hard evidence.
And like what kind of evidence?
Historical court records, philosophical tracts, theological texts, art, literature, all of it.
That scholarly distance is what makes this so powerful, by treating the devil as a historical phenomenon to be analyzed.
And not a spiritual entity to be believed or disbelieved.
Oldridge gives us this really objective and insightful exploration. He shows us how the belief functioned as a social force, which is the important part, regardless of what you personally believe.
It's all about the effect of the belief on human society.
Okay, so let's unpack this journey. Oldridge's whole purpose is to demystify the devil by showing how he was historicized, that he was built piece by piece.
Stripping away all the layers of myth and pop culture. And the book takes you on this sweeping chronological journey. We're talking over 2 millennia.
And that journey is just a series of these massive paradigm-shifting transformations.
It really is. It starts in the ancient Near East, where the Hebrew Satan figure is. Well, he's subtle. He's a functionary in God's heavenly court.
Not some ultimate evil, more like a part of the system.
Exactly. Then it solidifies in a huge way in the New Testament. He morphs into the definitive malevolent enemy, the tempter, the serpent, the dragon.
And then that theological blueprint meets popular imagination.
Right, in the medieval period. And that's where he gets that iconic, monstrous physical form.
The horns, the tail, the whole look.
He goes from this abstract threat to something.
Yeah.
Tactile, a constant, intimate presence.
And then he goes through these two incredible modern shifts. First, becoming terrifyingly real and active during the witch hunts.
And second, he gets completely secularized by the Enlightenment. He becomes a psychological symbol, the shadow self. And he lives on in, literature and film.
So every version of the devil tells us something critical about the era that produced it. It's the story of humanity trying to explain suffering and rationalize conflict.
Let's start at the very beginning, then, with the making of the devil. What Oldridge really stresses here is the surprising role of Satan in the Hebrew book of Job.
What's so amazing here is that the Hebrew word Satan just means adversary or accuser.
It's a job title, not a name.
Exactly. In the book of Job, he's basically a celestial prosecutor. He's a loyal, if maybe a little cynical, member of God's court.
And he's acting with God's express permission.
He's challenging God, saying, look, Job only serves you because you reward him. take away his comfort, and he'll curse you.
I find that incredible. The ultimate villain started as a loyal civil servant. He's not defying God. He's taking the other side in a legal argument.
So how does that distinction, you know, prosecutor versus cosmic rival, get lost so fast in the New Testament?
Well, that's the hinge point of the book. Aldridge suggests this shift probably wouldn't have happened without some external influence.
Like what?
Specifically, the system of Zoroastrian dualism from ancient Persia. Zoroastrianism had this built-in cosmic war. Ahura Mazda, the good god, in a constant battle with Angra Mainyu, the destructive evil spirit.
Ah, so it's a conceptual model for a full-on cosmic battle.
It's the blueprint. Once that idea of ultimate independent evil enters the worldview, the original Hebrew Satan, the loyal tester, has to be redefined to fit this new role.
The role of the supreme opponent.
Precisely. By the time we get to the New Testament, the figure is consolidated. He's the tempter in the wilderness, the supreme adversary, and in the book of Revelation, he's the apocalyptic dragon cast down to wage war on humanity.
And that just sets the stage for centuries of Christian demonology.
From that theological blueprint, we move into the medieval devil, which is where the physical imagination just takes over.
This is where he gets his wardrobe and his pitchfork.
Exactly. Transforming from a concept into a terrifying, recognizable figure. But first came the doctrine. Theologians like St. Augustine, they provided the philosophical foundation.
Defining his sin as pride, right.
Pride, and critically defining the nature of evil itself as a privation of good.
Wait, a privation of good. So evil is just the absence of good, like a shadow is the absence of light?
That's the idea, privatio boni.
But how does that philosophical idea translate into a horrifying active figure that medieval peasants feared would, you know, steal their kids or ruin their crops? How do you get from a philosophical void to a horned monster?
That is the crucial tension. The abstract doctrine, that satisfied the theologians. But it didn't satisfy the popular need for an explanation for pain and chaos.
So pop culture took over.
Popular art, really. It drew on older, non-Christian folklore. The devil basically absorbed traits from nature deities like the Greek god Pan or the Celtic Cernunnos.
So the horns, the hooves, the tail, those were all elements from ancient pagan fertility and nature spirits.
Yeah. The church essentially took those powerful pre-Christian images and just repurposed them.
Transforming them from symbols of natural wildness into symbols of spiritual corruption.
Exactly. The medieval devil was this intimate, constant presence, always trying to tempt people. He was terrifying, for sure, but also often portrayed as kind of clumsy or stupid in morality plays.
Reinforcing the idea that faith, or even a clever peasant, could outwit him, he was a practical explanation for bad luck.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting. The Reformation paradox.
Right. Most people assume the Reformation was a step toward rational modern thought. But chapter 4, The Devil in the Age of Reformation, tells a very different story.
It really does. The Reformation didn't weaken belief in the devil. It radically intensified it.
How so?
Well, reformers like Martin Luther and John Calvin saw the world not through some emerging scientific lens, but as a fierce, immediate, existential, spiritual battlefield.
And how did that actually manifest? It sounds terrifying.
It was intensely personal. Luther, for instance, saw the devil as this immensely powerful being who was physically active in his own life.
He didn't just believe in him. He claimed to battle him directly.
Yeah, there's that famous story of Luther throwing an ink pot at the devil. And more broadly, he saw his entire struggle against the Catholic Church as a cosmic war. He literally called the Pope the Antichrist.
So every political and religious conflict becomes part of this grand struggle between God and Satan. The stakes become astronomical.
They do. And this hyper-intense worldview led directly to the great European witch hunts from around 1450 to 1750.
Because if the devil is so active and intelligent, then his followers must be too.
Exactly. They must be consciously working to overthrow Christendom.
And that's what creates the deadly intellectual framework for the diabolical pact.
It wasn't just about practicing folk magic anymore. The idea was that witches had willingly renounced God and signed a contract with Satan for power. It made them traitors.
And texts like the infamous Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, they systematized this belief.
They did. They gave detailed instructions for identifying and prosecuting the devil's allies. And that allowed institutions to turn social anxiety into organized, widespread persecution. Mass hysteria.
That incredible power had to meet a challenge eventually. And that challenge comes in the decline of the devil with the rise of modern rationalism.
That's the story of the Enlightenment, the scientific revolution. Figures like Voltaire, They offered natural physical explanations for things that had always been blamed on the devil.
Like diseases, storms, bad crops.
Right. Why blame a demon when you can blame weather patterns or microbiology?
So the devil was effectively pushed to the margins of elite intellectual thought. If he can't explain the physical world, what's his job?
He didn't disappear. He was just reborn in secular forms. We see him in literature, like in Milton's Paradise Lost.
Where Satan is reinvented, he's no longer a clumsy medieval monster.
No, he's complex, sympathetic, even a heroic rebel in a way, a figure of romantic defiance against overwhelming authority.
And then psychology comes along in the 20th century and offers the ultimate secular interpretation.
Think of Carl Jung and his concept of the shadow. The dark, repressed parts of our personality we don't want to acknowledge. The devil becomes the archetype for that repressed self.
So instead of an external monster, the evil becomes internal. The capacity for darkness that's inside all of us.
Exactly. And at the same time, he proved immensely powerful in popular culture. He maintains his grip through horror films like Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist. They tap into very contemporary anxieties about faith and science and control.
That resilience brings us to the core themes. Why studying this construct matters beyond just history.
I'd say the number one takeaway is the devil as a social constructor. His image is completely malleable. It changes to reflect what society needs.
So when plagues were the threat, he's a physical monster.
During religious wars, he's the master strategist behind heresy. His identity is always a function of society's biggest threats.
Which leads right into the next theme. The devil as a tool for scapegoating and control.
Absolutely. Oldridge shows, unequivocally, that the belief has been used over and over to enforce social norms and justify persecution.
If you can define your opponent, a heretic, a political rival, a woman who threatens your authority as an agent of the devil,
then you can justify any level of violence against them.
The witch hunts are the ultimate horrifying example of that.
And that brings up the last thing, the resilience of diabolic categories. Even when literal belief declined, the logic of absolute ultimate evil persisted.
We see it in secular frameworks today.
All the time. In political ideologies, in how we demonize rivals, and how we frame global threats, there's this continuing human need to personify evil.
To really crystallize these points, let's share some of the most potent ideas from the book.
The first core idea is basically this. The devil we know is not a biblical invention, but a historical creation assembled over centuries.
It reminds you that the iconic figure isn't monolithic. He's a composite, built piece by piece to mirror our changing anxieties.
Then there's the second idea, which captures that historical paradox we talked about. The Protestant Reformation did not weaken belief in the devil. It placed him at the very center of a cosmic struggle.
Making him a more urgent and terrifying presence in daily life than ever before. That just flips the whole idea of historical progress on its head.
It really does. And maybe the most insightful modern message is this. The devil's greatest victory may be convincing modern people he never existed.
For this blinds us to the very real power of the diabolic logic that continues to shape our world.
That connects the history directly to modern critical thinking. We have to recognize the pattern of that thinking, even if we reject the entity.
Which leads us perfectly to the real-life applications. How do we, the curious learner, actually use this deep dive?
Application one, critical thinking about binary narratives. This history just encourages us to be highly skeptical of simplistic good versus evil stories in modern discourse.
You have to ask, who benefits from defining an opponent as fundamentally evil?
Exactly. Oldridge's work teaches us to look for the social tension underneath that moral label.
And application two, recognizing modern moral panics. The witch trials are this stark, terrifying case study in how mass hysteria works.
Understanding that helps us recognize similar patterns today. When social fears combine with institutional power to target a specific group, that ancient scapegoating mechanism just resurfaces.
You have to identify when the logic of the diabolical pact, that there's a hidden internal enemy undermining society, is being used.
And finally, application three, grappling with internal darkness. That modern psychological interpretation of the devil as the Jungian shadow gives us a really valuable framework.
So instead of projecting our destructive tendencies onto some external force,
this history encourages us to confront them as integral parts of our own complex human condition. It demands self-awareness, instead of projection.
You know, I think what surprised me most was just how contingent the devil's development was. The fact that the Satan in the book of Job was basically a loyal functionary of God.
The internal tester.
Yeah. The idea that this figure of profound cosmic evil was originally just a guy doing his job. It really drives home how much the concept was built over time to meet humanity's needs for externalizing its darkest fears.
It does. And the final takeaway for you to mull over is this. The devil is ultimately a historical and psychological phenomenon, a dark mirror held up to humanity. By tracing his story, from ancient prosecutor to modern shadow, we learn not about the metaphysics of evil, but about the very human, continuing need to name our deepest fears and justify our conflicts.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.